This is a reading of the Agriculture Cycle by Rudolf Steiner. This is the last lecture in the set. It's called Lecture 8, although there's a discussion later on. This was given in Kobervitz, Monday, June 16th, 1924. In this last lecture, I hope to round off the course as much as possible and also give some practical advice. In the question and answer session to follow, we will still be able to add a few things according to your particular needs. The practical matters that we will be dealing with today are not easily expressed as general formulas or the like, since they are subject to a great deal of individualization and personal discretion. And that is why it is so important to acquire spiritual scientific insights into the subject. They enable us to adapt our practices to individual situations in an intelligent manner. Just think how little insight exists today in the extremely important area of animal nutrition. And in fact, this state of affairs does not improve much, no matter how many indications are given about what should be fed. I am convinced that it could be greatly improved, however, if agricultural education were to place more emphasis on gaining insight into the fundamental nature of animal nutrition. I would like to make a start in that direction today. As I have already pointed out, what food signifies for animals and human beings is always completely misunderstood. The important point is not the crude process whereby foodstuffs are taken up from outside and then deposited in the body, as people always imagine, even if they also imagine all kinds of transformations along the way. Basically, people imagine that first the food is there outside, then the animal eats it, and then what the animal can use is deposited inside the body, and what it cannot use is excreted. As a consequence, people are concerned about not overburdening the animal's digestion, and about giving it nourishing fodder that contains as many nutritive substances as possible. And people who are fond of making materialistic distinctions certainly also distinguish between actual nutrient substances and other substances that support the body's so-called combustion process. All kinds of theories, with all kinds of practical consequences, are based on these ideas. As you can imagine, some of them work and some of them don't, or they work only for a while and then have to be modified. What else can you expect? People talk about a combustion process going on inside the body, but this is nonsense, of course. When some substance or other combines with oxygen inside an organism, that process is totally different from a combustion process. Combustion is a process in non-living nature. Just as a living organism is something different than a quartz crystal, so too is what is designated as combustion within the organism something different from the dead process of combustion that takes place outside. In the organism, it is something alive and even sentient. When people talk about combustion going on inside the body, this causes untold mischief, even though they may only be expressing themselves sloppily. Sloppy talk is harmless as long as people have the right idea in mind and do things even halfway appropriately out of instinct or tradition. But when what I've often called psychopathia professora, starts to take over, it turns this sloppy talk into all kinds of ingenious theories. Then when people start to act in accordance with these theories, they totally miss the mark. What they talk about becomes something totally different from what is really going on in plants and animals. It is a typically modern phenomenon for people to do things that are totally at odds with what is happening in nature. That is why we need to spend a bit of time looking at what's really involved here. Let us consider something we talked about yesterday, namely that a plant has a physical body and an etheric body, and is surrounded by astrality. The plants themselves don't reach the stage of astrality, but it hovers around them. When a plant enters into a particular connection with this astrality, as is the case in fruit formation, something nourishing is produced, something which can then support the astrality that is in the animal or human organism. If you really understand this process, you will be able to tell simply by looking at a plant or anything else whether or not it is capable of supporting one thing or another in the animal organism. But now I think we need also to look at the other pole, for something of great importance exists there. I have already touched upon this, but it needs to be specially emphasized again here, because we are trying to establish the principles involved in feeding animals. Since that is what concerns us now, let us take the animal as our starting point. There is not such a clear-cut threefoldness in the animal organism as there is in human beings. In animals, both the nerve sense system and the metabolic limb system are clearly defined and distinct from one another. But in many animals, the middle, rhythmic system, is indistinct. Some of what originates in the sensory system gets into the rhythmic system, and so does some of what originates in the metabolism. Therefore, we need to speak differently about animals than we do about human beings. With human beings, it is quite correct to talk about a threefold organism. With animals, we can refer to the nerve sense system localized primarily in the head, and the metabolic limb system localized primarily in the hind end of the body and the limbs. But in the middle, the metabolism and the nerve sense system both become more rhythmical than in human beings. They flow into each other. Thus, the rhythmic system in animals does not become so independent. It is more like an unclear reverberation of the two polar extremes. In the case of animals, we should actually be talking about a twofold organism in which the two systems meet and mingle in the middle. And there's a drawing now. Now, everything in the way of substance in the head system consists entirely of earthly matter. This is also true of humans, but let us stay with animals for the time being. Earthly matter is already being channeled into the head system during the embryonic period. The embryo has to be organized in such a way that its head acquires its substances from the earth. So earthly substance is to be found within the head. On the other hand, the substances of our metabolic limb system, everything constituting our intestines, limbs, muscles, bones, and so forth, does not come from the earth, but from what is absorbed out of the air and warmth above the earth. That is cosmic substantiality. It is important not to look at a hoof as if it were formed from physical material that has been consumed by the animal and then made its way into the hoof and been deposited there. That is simply not true. The cosmic matter in the hoof is absorbed through the senses and through breathing. And what the animal eats is simply there to develop its forces of movement, so that the cosmic factor can be driven into its metabolic limb system, right into its hoofs, for instance. These parts of the body are filled with cosmic substantiality. With respect to the forces, however, the reverse is true. In the head, we have to do with cosmic forces, since the cosmos is perceived with the senses, which are located primarily in the head. In the metabolic limb system, on the other hand, we have to do with earthly forces, with cosmic substances, but earthly forces. Just think how we are constantly engaged with earthly heaviness when we walk, how in fact everything we do with our limbs is connected with the earth. If you are going to use cattle as draft animals, it is really quite important to feed them in such a way that they take in as much cosmic substantiality as possible, and also to make sure that the fodder passing through their stomachs provides plenty of forces to guide this cosmic substantiality into their limbs, into their muscles and bones. Similarly, you must know that the substances used by the head have to be derived from the fodder itself, and that the fodder digested in the stomach has to be guided into the head. In this respect, it is the head, and not the big toe, that is directly dependent on the stomach. And you must understand that the head can assimilate the nourishment it receives from the body only if it can also obtain the forces from the cosmos. That is why it is important to not keep animals confined in dark stalls where no cosmic forces can reach them, but to let them out to pasture and give them opportunities to interact with their surroundings through their senses. Just picture an animal in some dark and airless building, standing in front of a feeding trough that contains whatever human wisdom has doled out. If it never has the opportunity to be outdoors, this animal will be very different from an animal that can roam freely and use its senses, its sense of smell, for instance, to seek out the cosmic forces. It will be very different from an animal that actively searches for its own food. The animal left in front of the trough will not immediately show that it has no more cosmic forces. It still inherits some. But this deficiency will gradually become apparent in its descendants. These animals will become weak because of their head. That is, they will not be able to nourish their bodies because they will be unable to absorb the cosmic substances that their bodies require. These things will show you that what is important is not to come up with generalities about what to feed in this or that instance, but rather to understand what value particular feeding methods have for the animal's entire being and constitution. Let's go on now. We have seen that the head contains earthly substantiality. Thus, if you consider an animal's noblest organ, its brain, there you have earthly substantiality. Our own brain also contains earthly substantiality. The forces are cosmic, but the substances are earthly. Now, what is the purpose of this brain? It serves as a foundation for the ego. Animals, however, do not yet have an ego. Let us be sure we get this right. The brain serves as a foundation for the ego, yet the animal has no ego. Its brain is only on the way to ego formation, while in human beings the process goes much further. So how does the brain come about? Consider the body's organic processes. Everything that goes on in there, everything that appears in the brain as earthly matter, is actually an excretion from these organic processes. Earthly matter is excreted in order to serve as a foundation for the ego. Now, on the basis of the process in which foodstuffs are consumed, digested, and distributed by the metabolic limb system, a certain amount of earthly matter is able to reach the head and the brain, and in this way a certain amount of earthly substance is actually deposited in the brain. But the foodstuffs are not only deposited in the brain, they are also excreted by the intestines along the way. Whatever cannot be further assimilated is deposited in the intestines. And here we encounter a relationship that you may find paradoxical, but we cannot ignore it if we want to understand either the animal or the human organization. What is the brain mass actually? The substance of the brain is simply intestinal content taken as far as possible, whereas premature brain deposits pass out through the intestine. The contents of the intestine, as regards their processes, are very much related to the contents of the brain. It would be crass to say that what is present in the brain is simply a more highly developed manure pile, but objectively this is quite correct. The manure is transformed by means of the organic process into the noble substance of the brain, where it becomes the basis for the development of the ego. With human beings, as much as possible of the gut nature is transformed into brain manure, in quotes, because human beings have their ego on earth. With animals, less is transformed, so more is left behind in the gut manure, which is then used as fertilizer. More ego is left behind as potentiality. Because animals don't reach the ego stage of development, animal manure contains more ego potential. Animal manure and human manure are two completely different things. Animal manure still contains ego potential, and so we discover that when we fertilize, when we bring manure to the plant roots, we are bringing ego to the roots. If we draw a complete plant, with the roots down here and the leaves and blossoms up here, there's a drawing, we find that the astrality develops up here in interaction with the air, and that the plant's ego potential develops down here in interaction with the manure. A farm of this kind is truly a living organism. Up above, through the presence of forest and orchard, it develops its astrality. When the animals feed properly on what is above the earth, they then develop the proper ego forces in their manure, which in turn allow the plants to properly grow out from their roots in alignment with the force of gravity. This is a wonderful interaction, and we must try to come to an even better understanding of it. Because of this interaction, you see, a farm is a kind of individuality, and you will soon realize that your animals and plants should participate in this as much as possible. Nature is impaired, in a certain sense, if the farm animals are eliminated and fertilizer is brought in from Chile instead of manure being supplied by the animals on the farm. You then step out of what used to be, and should continue to be, a self-contained cycle. You must arrange things so that the cycle becomes self-sustaining. You must simply have the right number and kinds of animals on a farm so that you get enough of the right manure. And you must also make sure that you plant what your animals will instinctively search out and want to eat. Setting up experiments naturally becomes very complicated here, because they have to be individualized. What we must do, therefore, is establish general guidelines on how to set up such experiments. After many experiments, practical rules will emerge, but they will all have to be derived from our primary guiding principle, which is to make each farm so self-contained that it can become self-sustaining, albeit not completely. Why not completely? Because studying things objectively in the sense of spiritual science does not turn people into fanatics, and under present economic conditions it is impossible to achieve this completely. Nevertheless, as far as is possible, we should try to achieve it. So, by now, we should be able to discover, in concrete terms, how the animal organism relates to the plant organism, that is, to the plant as fodder. Let us consider this first in quite general terms. Look at the root. As a rule, the root develops within the soil, which the manure has permeated with incipient ego force. Simply by virtue of how it exists in the soil, the root absorbs the incipient ego force, and this process is helped if it can find the right amount of salts in the soil. Let's assume that we do not know anything about roots except what we have just considered. From this alone, we can see that roots will be the form of nourishment that will most easily find their way to the head when they have entered the body through the digestive system. Therefore, when we want to provide actual material substances for the head, we ought to provide roots as fodder, so that the cosmic forces, working through the head, will find the right material for their formative sculptural activity. You can imagine someone putting it like this, quote, "I must give root fodder to an animal that needs substances conducted to its head, so that it can become as active as possible in its senses, so that it can develop a cosmic relationship to its cosmic surroundings," unquote. Don't you think immediately of the calf and the carrot? When a calf eats a carrot, you have brought the whole process to completion. If you know what things look like and how they grow, making a statement like this will lead you directly to what ought to be done. You simply need to know how this process works. Let us continue. Once the substance has really been guided into the head, once we have fed the calf with the carrot, then the reverse process must be allowed to begin. In other words, the head must now be able to work as force, as will, and thus also be able to engender forces in the organism, so that these in turn can be worked into the organism. It is not enough for the carrot manure to be deposited in the head. From what is deposited there, that is, from what is in the process of being broken down, force radiations must enter into the body. In other words, you need a second kind of fodder, which will let a particular part of the body, in this case the head, work upon the rest of the body in the right way, after it has itself received what it needs. So, suppose I've supplied the carrots, and now I want the body to be properly permeated with forces that can develop from the head. I need something that naturally has a ray-like form, or else something in which this radiating tendency is gathered together and concentrated. So what do we need? In addition to carrots, we need a second kind of fodder from a plant with a raying-out tendency that is then gathered together again. What comes to mind is flax seed and things like that. If you feed a calf a combination of carrots and flax seed or some other pair of complementary fodders such as new hay and carrots, you will get something that will regulate the entire organism and set the animal on its proper path of development. We must try to give young cattle the kinds of fodder that promote the ego force and also promote what proceeds from above downward, the astral filling out. This applies particularly to anything which has long stems and is simply left to its own development. In other words, to anything long-stemmed that turns into hay. And there is a drawing here. Thus, in looking not only at this particular issue, but also at the farm as a whole, we must be aware of what happens to each single thing as it makes its way, either from the animals into the soil, or from the plants into the animals. Let's carry on and look at an animal that needs to be strong in the mid-region, where the head or nerve sense system develops in the direction of the respiration, and where the metabolic system develops in the direction of the rhythmic system, that is, where the two interpenetrate. Which animals need to be strong in this region? The dairy animals must be strong in this particular area in order for milk production to take place. To ensure good milk production, we have to make certain that there is a proper interaction between the stream flowing from the head toward the tail, which is primarily a stream of forces, and a stream flowing from behind toward the front, which is primarily a stream of substances. If the stream flowing from behind forward is worked through as thoroughly as possible by the forces flowing from front to back, then you will get good milk, and a lot of it. This good milk is particularly a product of the metabolic process. It is a substance whose preparation has made it very similar to the sexual metabolic process, although it has not gone through the sexual system itself. Milk is simply a transformed sexual gland secretion, a substance on the way to becoming a sexual secretion that has been transformed in its encounter with the head forces. There is nothing incomprehensible about this process. It is quite possible to understand what is taking place. For processes of this kind, we need to look for a type of fodder that does not work as strongly in the direction of the head as roots do, which have absorbed the ego force. However, since it also has to remain related to the sexual force, it should not have too much astrality, not too much of the blossoming and fruiting tendency. This means that for milk production, we need to turn to what lies between the flower and the root, to what is green and leafy, to everything that develops as foliage. And there's a drawing. Let's assume that I am giving leafy fodder to a dairy cow, because that's what is available. I now want to increase her milk production. I believe this is possible. So what do? I use plants that take the fruiting process, the process that occurs in flowers and in fruits, and bring it into the leafing process. This is what the pulses do, for example, or especially the different varieties of clover. With respect to its substance, what is fruit-like in clover develops just like a leaf. With this treatment, you won't notice too much difference in the cow herself, but when she calves, this calf will then become a good dairy cow. Reforms in feeding practices usually take a generation to work themselves out. Now, in this area of feeding, there is one thing that must be particularly kept in mind. When the old traditions of instinctive wisdom vanished, people held onto a few things in this area, just as doctors have held onto a few remedies without knowing why anymore, simply because they had always worked. People still know a few things from the old traditions, but they no longer know why the things were used. And so for the rest, they experiment. They try this for the milking animals and that in order to fatten the animals and so on. The result is similar to what happens when things are tried out on humans, especially when this experimentation is simply left to chance. Just think what happens when you are with many friends and happen to have a sore throat. Each of your friends gives you something or other for it, and in half an hour you've collected enough to stock a whole pharmacy. If you took all of those things, they would cancel each other out, and you would probably end up with an upset stomach and still have a sore throat. In these circumstances, something quite simple becomes something quite complicated. It is similar when you start experimenting with all kinds of fodder. You try something out, and it works in one respect, but not in another. So you add a second kind of fodder, and then a third, until you have any number of fodders, each of particular value for young animals, or animals to be fattened, or whatever. Very soon, it all gets so complicated that you no longer have an overview of the situation. You can no longer see how the forces interact, or the effects of the different things start to cancel each other out. That is actually what often happens, especially with people who take up farming in a semi-academic way. They look it up in their books, or they recollect what they were taught. They look it all up, but that doesn't help much, because what they read in their books may well conflict with what they are already doing. This situation can only be dealt with rationally by thinking along the lines I have indicated. In that way, the question of animal nutrition is considerably simplified, so that it is possible to have an overview of it. You can understand the way carrots and flax seed work. It is comprehensible, and you don't get everything mixed up. You comprehend the effect of what it is you are feeding. Just think what it would be like to do everything in farming as consciously and deliberately as that. That is how you will learn to simplify rather than complicate the feeding of your animals. A lot of what has been discovered through trial and error is perfectly correct, but unsystematic and imprecise. The kind of precision applied nowadays is actually imprecise because everything gets muddled up together and nothing is understood. On the other hand, the interactions I have presented are simple enough that you can clearly trace them right into the animal organism. Let's take another example. Let's turn to the flower and the fruiting process within the flower. But we can't stop there. We must also look at the fruiting process in the other parts of the plant. It is characteristic of plants, and that is why Goethe was so fond of them, that the potential to develop any of their parts is present throughout their body. With most kinds of plants, in order to get new plants, you must take germ of the fruit that appears in the flower and put this into the ground. With potatoes, however, it is different. There you use the eyes of the tubers. In many of our plants, the fruiting process is complete, but not everything in nature is pushed to the final stage. You can always enhance an incomplete fruiting process, however, by means of processes that are outwardly similar to outer combustion. Thus, if you feed any chopped and dried tubers or similar plant parts, these will become more effective if you first spread them out in the sun to steam a bit. There the latent tendency is taken a little further toward fruiting. A wonderful instinct is involved here. If you look at the world intelligently, you might well wonder how it ever occurred to people to cook their food. We usually don't stop to wonder about things that are around us all the time. But this is a legitimate question. How did people ever get the idea to cook their food? Well, it happened because they gradually discovered that the processes inherent in cooking, in burning, warming, drying, steaming, and so on, play a role in every fruiting process. These processes make the flowers and seeds in particular, but indirectly also all the upper parts of the plant, especially suitable for stimulating the kind of forces that are needed by the animal's metabolic limb system. Even when the flower and seed parts of the plant are given as fodder, without being cooked, they work on an animal's digestive system, primarily by means of the forces they contain rather than through their substantiality. The metabolic limb system requires earthly forces, and we must meet this need. Think of the animals that graze in the Alps. They are not like the animals on the plains. They have to walk around under difficult circumstances, since the ground isn't level. It makes a difference whether animals have to walk on level or sloping ground. Animals in the mountains need something to help them develop the forces in their limbs that their will must exert. Otherwise, they would not be good for work or for milk or meat. You must therefore make sure that enough of their fodder comes from the aromatic alpine herbs, in which nature itself has enhanced the flowering and fruiting parts through the sun's cooking process. And further cooking or simmering of the fodder will also bring force into the limbs. It is best to use what comes from the fruiting and flowering parts of plants, especially of plants that have a strong natural tendency to flower and fruit, plants that do not develop much in the way of leaves, but quickly bloom and bear fruit. These plants, which place little value on leaf development, and which allow flowers and fruit to proliferate, should be cooked. And it would also be good if people would sometimes take note of these things for themselves. We would then have fewer instances of people who slide into indolence by telling themselves that if they are active the whole day, they will not be able to become real mystics. Such people are convinced that they can become real mystics only if they stay quiet and still and are not stimulated by themselves or their surroundings. In effect, they say to themselves and their surroundings, "I can't spare any strength for working. I want to become a real mystic, and so I will also arrange my diet so that I become more mystical." They thus become raw food enthusiasts. They stop cooking altogether and eat only raw foods. These things are deceiving, however, and do not always work out the way people expect. People who already have weak constitutions, who are already on the way to becoming mystics of this sort, will, of course, make great progress. They become more and more lethargic, that is to say, more and more mystical. Parenthesis, and since what happens to people also applies to animals, we know what will make our animals alert and lively. Parenthesis. With people, however, it can also turn out differently. It can happen that they have strong physical constitutions and only later develop the eccentricity of wanting to become mystics. In that case, the inner forces that are developed by working on the raw food will simply augment the forces these people already have. This will not harm them. In fact, if in this way they summon up and transform forces that would otherwise remain below and cause rheumatism and gout, they will become all the stronger. These things all have two sides, like the two pans of a balance. We have to learn to apply them differently in individual instances. There are no hard and fast rules. The real advantage of a vegetarian's lifestyle is that it makes people fundamentally stronger by calling up forces that would otherwise lie fallow in the body. These are really the same forces as those that cause gout, rheumatism, diabetes, and so forth. When only plant foods are eaten, these forces are active in ripening the plants for the human being. But when animals are eaten, these forces are not used and begin to accumulate in the body. They then begin to act on their own. They deposit the products of metabolism in all kinds of places, or they expel from the organs and claim for themselves certain things that the human being needs, as in diabetes, and so on. Without insight into the principles, these things cannot be understood. And now, on the subject of how to fatten animals, we must imagine that we are filling a sack with as much cosmic substance as possible. Oh, those fat pigs, what heavenly creatures they are! For, with the exception of their nerve sense systems, their fat bodies consist entirely of cosmic substance, not earthly substance. They take in large amounts of cosmic substance from all sides. What they eat is only needed in order to distribute this cosmic substance to the different parts of their bodies. Pigs must eat in order to have the forces for distributing the substance that is drawn from the cosmos. And the same is true of other fattening animals. You will find that such animals put on weight when you give them fodder with an inherent fruiting tendency, preferably treated further by boiling or steaming, and also when you give them fodder where the inherent fruiting tendency has been enhanced by cultivation, as with fodder beets or turnips, for instance, which grow larger under cultivation than they did in the wild. So, What should we feed the animals that we want to fatten? Well, they need something that helps as much as possible to distribute the cosmic substance. That is to say, something with a strong fruiting tendency, which has also had some further treatments. This condition is largely met by certain kinds of oilseed cakes and the like. But we can't completely ignore these animals' heads. Some earthly substances still have to get through to their heads. We need to supplement their fattening feed with something else, though only in small amounts, since in this case the needs of the head are minimal. Thus we should add something root-like to the fodder of these animals, even if only in very small amounts. In general, we can say that what is root-like has a function in relation to the head, what is flower-like has a function in relation to the metabolic limb system, and what is leaf-like has a function in relation to the substantiality of the human rhythmic system. But there are also substances of another sort, pure substances that have no specialized function in the body. What we also need to provide, because they work on all parts of the animal organism, are the salt-like substances. Since salt makes up only a very small proportion of what both humans and animals consume, you can see from this that it is not always the quantity that counts, but rather the quality. Small amounts will suffice if the quality is right. Now, there is still one especially important subject I want to mention. I would like to ask you to carry out very precise experiments in this area, experiments which can also be extended to include human beings if they happen to like this food. You know that tomatoes were introduced as a food only relatively recently. Many people are very fond of them, but they are also an extraordinarily important thing to study. You can learn an extraordinary amount by studying tomato production and consumption. People who have given the matter a bit of thought, and there certainly are such people nowadays, believe that tomato consumption is highly significant for human beings. This is true, and it could also be said of animals, for it would be quite possible for animals to get used to eating tomatoes. Tomatoes have a significant effect on everything that tends to separate itself from the organism and develop an independent organization within the body. Two things follow from this. On the one hand, it confirms the statement of an American researcher, namely, that under certain circumstances, adding tomatoes to the diet can have a beneficial effect on an unhealthy human liver, because the liver is the organ that works most independently in the human body. When the liver is diseased, especially in animals, it could also be treated in general with tomatoes. Here we gain insight into the relationship between plants and animals. On the other hand, therefore, let me say this in parenthesis, people diagnosed as having cancer should immediately be forbidden to eat tomatoes, because cancer, from its very inception, makes a certain part of the human or animal body independent of the rest of the organism. But now we need to ask ourselves, why do tomatoes in particular have such a strong effect on everything that tends to be independent, on everything that specializes and separates itself off from the rest of the organism? This tendency is directly related to what tomatoes prefer and require for their own growth. Tomatoes feel most at home when they are given manure or compost that is as close as possible to the form in which it comes from the animal or other source. They prefer raw compost that hasn't had much chance to be transformed through natural processes. If you just throw all kinds of scraps together onto an untidy heap and give the heap no further treatment or preparation, you'll find that the most beautiful tomatoes will grow there. And if you were to use compost made from tomato plants, that is, if you were to let the tomatoes grow in their own compost, they would grow even better. Tomatoes have no desire to step outside of themselves, no desire to step outside of the realm of strong vitality. That's where they want to stay. They are the least social beings in the entire plant kingdom. They do not want anything from strangers, and above all, they do not want any fertilizer that has gone through a composting process. They reject all that. This is the reason that they can influence what works independently within the human or animal organism. And in this respect, potatoes are somewhat similar to tomatoes. They too act extremely independently. That is to say, they tend to pass very easily through the whole digestive process and then enter the brain and make it independent. They make it independent even of the influences of the other organs in the human body. From the time potatoes were first grown in Europe, excessive potato consumption has contributed toward making human beings and animals materialistic. We should eat only enough potatoes so that our brain and our head in general are stimulated. Potato consumption in particular should not be overdone. Knowing these things brings agriculture into intimate relationship with society in an objective way. And this is what is so important, that agriculture be related to the whole of social life. In these lectures, I have only been able to supply certain guidelines, of course, but I am sure that they will provide a foundation for many different experiments extending over a long period of time, and that they will lead to brilliant results if worked into your agronomical practices on an experimental basis. That should be a guideline for dealing with the material presented in this course. I am in complete agreement with the decision of the farmers participating in this course, that what you have learned here should not leave this group, but should serve as a basis for experimentation, and that the Farmers Association, the Agricultural Experimental Circle, will determine when the experiments have proceeded far enough for this material to be made public. Because of the admirable tolerance prevailing here, it has been possible for a number of interested people who are not actually farmers to take part in this course. These people will have to recall the well-known opera and put a lock on their mouths and not fall into the common anthroposophical failing of immediately proclaiming these things far and wide. We have often come to grief because people who were not actually qualified to talk about something simply went around repeating what they had heard. It makes a great difference whether the person talking about these things is a farmer or someone only remotely connected to farming. You can readily understand this. What would happen if non-farmers started spreading all this around as a new and interesting chapter in the study of anthroposophy? What would happen, and this has already happened with other lecture cycles, is simply that other people, including farmers, would hear about it from the wrong source. Farmers that hear about it from other farmers will merely say, "Pity that they've lost their minds." That is what they will say the first time, and maybe the second. But when farmers actually see something working, they then have a hard time rejecting it out of hand. On the other hand, if they hear about it from people who are not professionals, but simply interested amateurs, then you can just as well forget about it. It will have been discredited and will not be able to develop further. For those friends who were only allowed to participate out of general interest and who are not part of the agricultural circle, it is imperative that they exercise restraint, that they keep these things to themselves and refrain from broadcasting them as people so often like to do with anthroposophy. Our dear friend Count Kaiserling announced this decision of the agricultural circle, and I must say I support it wholeheartedly. Now that we have come to the end of these lectures, except for the discussion to follow, allow me first to express my own satisfaction that all of you wanted to come and take part in everything that has been said here, and in everything that should come of this. On the other hand, I am sure I speak for all of us when I say that I hope that what has taken place here will prove to be useful and to have the deepest inner value. But now let us bring to mind two other things. Think of all the effort put in by Count and Countess Kaiserling and all the members of their household so that this course could happen in the way that it has. That required energy, a sense of purpose, anthroposophical good sense, total involvement in the cause of anthroposophy, self-sacrifice, and much more besides. And because of the way everything was arranged here, our work together toward great and fruitful goals for humanity could also acquire a truly festive character. In 5 minutes, we will have yet another opportunity to experience this festive hospitality. Everything surrounding this occasion, last but not least the great warmth and kindness of all the people who work in this house, has provided a wonderful festive setting for our work, so that in addition to having an agricultural conference, we could also celebrate a real agricultural festival. We offer Countess and Count Kaiserling our most heartfelt thanks for everything they have done for us during these 10 days, for everything they have done in the service of our cause, and for their kindness in welcoming all of us here and making our stay so pleasant. The end of Lecture 8.